The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Benjamin Wittes. Today on the podcast, Nathan Myhrvold, tech entrepreneur, culinary visionary, former Microsoft technology chief, and author of a recent Lawfare Research Paper Series article on strategic terrorism. Myhrvold, for those who have never heard of him, is the founder of a company called Intellectual Ventures. He also, however, wrote a paper we published back in July, arguing that law enforcement authorities are too focused on tactical terrorism, bomb plots, hijackings, and the like, and insufficiently focused on the threats of greatest magnitude, particularly biological threats. Myhrvold was in Washington this week, discussing his paper and his thesis in a series of high-level meetings with government officials. He stopped by Brookings to discuss the paper and the problem.
So when people think of Nathan Myhrvold, they think of Microsoft, of Intellectual Ventures, of food, of paleontology. Most people don't think of national security. How'd you get into this?
Well, I think like many people, after 9/11, I was drawn to the particular situation that the world and the United States find itself in, where terrorism isn't just an annoyance, but it's something that really is a major threat that shapes national policy. And I started thinking about what I could do to contribute. And what I concluded was that it was this insight on strategic terrorism that might be something that I could make a contribution to, because it was analogous in some ways to what had gone on in the personal computer industry that I'd been involved with.
How so?
Well, the thing that drove personal computers was the fact that microprocessors and memory and all those semiconductor technologies kept getting way more powerful at the same price or much cheaper at given level of power. That's usually called Moore's Law. And basically it said that every 12 to 18 months, the capability of computers doubled. Now that's an amazing thing. And it led companies that bet on that technology to completely wipe out the earlier mainframe computers, and to extend the reach of computers everywhere, into our pockets, into our homes, into our living rooms. Digital technology exists because this microprocessor revolution made computing cheap.
So I take it the extension is we're now making strategic terrorism cheap.
Well, throughout history, people have invented ever more powerful and devastating weapons. You know, from the rock to the bow and arrow to the gun to the missile. And sort of the ultimate extension of all of that was nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are fantastically destructive, but also enormously expensive and difficult to make. A single nuclear weapon can blow up a city, and it costs about as much as a city. And frankly, it's even harder to build than a city. And what that meant was that the most lethal weapons were only possessed by large nation states. As you know, Iran appears to have been seeking a nuclear weapon. It takes all of the resources they can possibly muster and years and years and years to try to eke their way up towards getting a weapon. The difference is now a variety of factors mean that you can get increasing lethality very cheaply. So in the same way that Moore's Law disrupted the computer industry, I think the increasing lethality of weapons and weaponry at decreasing cost is going to disrupt national security at almost every level.
So give us some examples of that. That's a sort of theoretical model. Your paper actually has a lot of sort of very granular kind of applications of that in terms of what you think individuals can do.
Well, let's start with some of the simple things. The simplest thing is that terrorist groups now have communications at least as good as the U.S. government did. You know, it used to be that only a government could afford to have instant communications with people all over the world, no matter where they were. The internet, cell phones, satellite phones, all of that technology gives small groups the ability to organize in a fashion that was not possible 20 years ago.
But that's not a lethality issue.
No, that's the simplest thing. What the lethality issue comes from two points. The first is it's easier to steal a nuclear weapon than ever before because there are so many nuclear weapons possessed by failed states or states fallen on hard times. But the more even scarier possibility is biology. Our advances in biotech, our meaning the world's advances in biotech, mean that a small group with a relatively modest budget could create weapons far more terrifying than nuclear weapons.
So when I read your paper, the heart of it is really about bio. I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff in there about nuclear proliferation. But at the end of the day, it seems to me what really scares you, and frankly what really scares me, is just the capacity in synthetic biology to create or simply to modify existing organisms and create your sort of own DIY WMD program. How plausible is it? And the question that everybody asks me, as you know, I've been sort of writing a book about trying to govern a world in which this is a reality. Question people always ask me is, if it's that easy to do, why hasn't it happened yet? So I want to turn that question to you. How plausible is it and why hasn't it happened yet?
It's happened. It's happened at least three times at small scale. Okay, the Rajneesh cult in Oregon created biological weapons and distributed them in salad bars. The Aum Shinrikyo terror cult had both a bioweapons program and a chemical weapons program and a nuclear program. And the chemical weapons program got advanced enough that they released sarin gas in Tokyo subway system and killed a bunch of people. They released it ineptly, as it turned out, but their sarin was perfectly good sarin, and they had a biological program. And Bruce Ivins, a government bioweapons expert, apparently perpetrated the anthrax attacks on the U.S. Senate and others that killed a bunch of people. So it's happened three times. Now, the attacks that happened in those three times are not attacks that killed tens of thousands or millions of people. I will grant you that. But the thing, the distance between what those groups did with far more primitive technology, since all those things are now reaching back 20 years in some cases. If you take that and you just fast forward a little bit and add new technology, I think it's very plausible that this could occur.
So you're a much more technically adept guy than I am. Could you do it?
Well, I'm not a biologist, but I think that almost anyone with sufficient technical training could learn how to do it over the internet, frankly. It certainly would be able to do it if they had an advanced degree in molecular biology. I mean, to give an example in that direction, Mohammed Atta, one of the 9/11 terrorists, had a master's degree in urban planning. If he'd had a master's degree in virology or molecular biology, he would be a lot more dangerous guy.
So one of the things that is fascinating to me is that terrorists, I mean, we'll get to the focal point on strategic terrorism in your paper in a moment, but one of the interesting things to me is that terrorists don't seem more interested in this than they are. You focused on the fact that the government is hopelessly mired in the tactical as opposed to the strategic, but it does seem like terrorists are really mercifully interested in the truck bomb as opposed to this. And my secret theory is that that's just because they're actually not very imaginative people, and that it sort of takes a KSM to kind of change the way they think about it. But do you agree with me that the basic problems here are imaginative and not technical?
I think you're right. And look, we're fortunate that more people haven't tried to do it than the three examples that I gave. I don't think there's a technical barrier or a capability, fundamental capability barrier. Or anyway, it's one that they could breach if they really put their minds to it. So far, they haven't. And that leads to one strategy I call the Blanche DuBois strategy. I've always relied on the kindness of strangers. Well, in a sense, our best strategy at the moment is we are relying on the kindness of terrorists to choose a truck bomb or a improvised pressure cooker bomb like the Tsarnaev brothers used in the Boston Marathon, rather than doing something more high-tech. But eventually, we'll find that imaginative guy. You mentioned KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was... by many accounts, one of the great masterminds of the era. Another KSM could come up with this. And I think if you wait long enough, eventually will.
Now, when you look at what the realistic capacity for such an event is, you describe it in your paper as potentially species ending. What's the realistic limit on what you could hope to do as a terrorist in this space?
Well, there's a good question as to what strategic goals a terrorist would have in launching an infectious bioagent. Infectious is important here because that's what causes all the harm, is that it passes from person to person. An attack that just kills people in an individual city, although horrible, isn't as bad as one where it just keeps on spreading all over the world. So it's possible, I think it's theoretically possible, that one could, with enough effort, engineer a bioweapon that would end the species or end civilization. And that sounds crazy and alarmist, and I almost hesitate to say it because it pushes you back the, oh my God, that couldn't be. But no, actually, I think it could be. Actually, a good example on the natural disease front is HIV. HIV is a very difficult disease for us to stop. We've not been able to create an effective vaccine yet. The only saving grace is that HIV actually takes a long time to kill you, and it's very hard to transmit. And so a combination of preventative measures and some therapy, antiretroviral drugs, have allowed us to control it many places, but not everywhere. If you had a disease that had a very long incubation time, as HIV does, incubation time meaning the time from that you get it to the time that you actually die of it, and higher lethality, and easier transmission, such a disease could spread in terrifying ways. But I don't think that there's a lot of terrorist groups that are going to say, right, let's end the species. But a lot of folks could have the intent of doing enormous harm to the world for a whole set of reasons. And some of that harm would be against their direct adversaries. But you can't control this stuff. It's like a wildfire that gets going where it can accidentally spread all over the place.
So are you primarily concerned here about terrorist groups or primarily concerned about lone, very high-functioning individuals. I'm thinking, you know, people like Bruce Ivins, or people like at a different level, Ted Kaczynski, right, who's the same artistry that goes into building bombs out of wood that you can send by the mail. You could imagine if his particular fixation were not technology, being a much more high-tech, much more dangerous person. On the other hand, one of the virtues or vices that organized groups bring is organization and capacity, right? And some part of me thinks that the biggest fear for this sort of thing is the lone individual, not Al-Qaeda.
Well, I think it's very hard to make a firm probability assessment of any of these things. There certainly are brilliant and deranged individuals. And the Unabomber Kaczynski is a great example. He gets a PhD in math from Harvard, but then decides his mission should be killing people one at a time with these very Baroque bombs. There are serial killers of all sorts that are smart enough to elude detection and kill enormous numbers of people, dozens of people easily. So, of course, there's going to be that. But there also are lots of terrorist groups. And by the way, it doesn't have to be Al-Qaeda. You know, Al-Qaeda has been the sworn enemy of the United States since 9/11. The United States has fought back, and Al-Qaeda is in a much more difficult position than it once was. Could a group like that do it? Yes, but it doesn't even have to be them. You know, a Chechen group attacks Moscow, or a Uyghur group attacks Beijing, and people from those cities will be in New York and Chicago and Los Angeles within 12 hours. So an attack anywhere in the world could blow back. So I'm not even sure it matters that much as to whether it's a lone, demented genius, a Kaczynski of biotech, or whether it's a separatist group or terrorist group in the way we think of them now.
Well, so here's why I think it does matter, at least one's assessment of what the weight of likelihood there is. If you believe that the basic problem is the possibility that known terrorist groups would get access to this material and use it or develop access, then there's a real then the government's current focus, which is in going after these groups and dismantling them and using these relatively small bore plots as the lever through which to do it, makes a certain amount of sense. Or at least maybe makes a certain amount of sense. On the other hand, if you believe that this is a sufficiently distributed technology or will become, that the thing that you really have to fear is what the lone individual does with it, then the focus on the groups is a huge misdirection, right? And so I guess to me the question of the scope of the distribution really does matter at some level.
I don't disagree with you. I just don't know how to measure it. Okay. Yes, there's a threat from the lone, mad scientist type. And yes, there's a threat from more organized non-state actors. And third, there probably is some degree of threat from some state actors. It's widely believed, for example, that North Korea has smallpox, has the smallpox virus. There are many of these different modalities, and I think that if it was a named group that we're already engaged with, like Al-Qaeda, their task in carrying out any mission is made much more difficult by the fact we're already onto them and we're doing everything we can to have one of those predator drones get whoever's the next number three. Being number three in that organization doesn't seem like it's a really good career path. Number two seems to have lasted for a long time, and number one had a good run. But being number three is a thankless task. So I think that there's plenty of independent calling it as a misdirection. It's a misdirection maybe from the parochial view of this problem, which I'm very into. I think we need to focus on several of the threats. And it's probably true, I'll grant you, that the sum of the threats of the lone gunman types, the lone bombers, that might be as great or greater than a known group like Al-Qaeda. So but I don't know how you'd ever measure it well enough. You can have a gut check that tells you that, and I respect that, but it's not clear to me that you could say, all right, we know the probability of the... I mean, who would have thought Aum Shinrikyo, right? This is a Japanese cult which is built around this brilliant but very strange guy named Shokuhara. A guy who was actually could see, he had some vision impairment, but pretended to be totally blind, went to schools for the blind, and damned if he didn't do really well. He is the living example of the adage that in the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. He had vision in one eye and somehow became top of the class in the school for the blind. Now, I don't think any... Is he a lone gunman? Well, no, not really lone. He actually had a cult that had, I think, a few hundred people in it. Privately financed, no government financing, no other things. It was it was doctors and lawyers and other wealthy people in Japan who joined his cult that provided the funding. And he convinced all those law-abiding Japanese citizens to go make these horrible weapons. I don't know how any pro forma analysis would say, right.
Right.
Let's look for Japanese quasi-religious cults.
So the core of your thesis is that our government is focused on threats of not the greatest magnitude and largely ignoring the threats of the greatest magnitude. Talk about that. How misaligned, in your judgment, are our priorities?
Well, here's, I think, the single biggest example for me is that right now, as we're recording this, there are tens of thousands, if you really added them all up, of people watching for Soviet missiles or bombers to do a strategic nuclear attack in the United States. Okay, it's inherited from the Cold War. There are people in submarines, there's people in radar stations, in missile silos, all waiting for this attack. Now, I think we can all agree that that attack is not very likely. Vladimir Putin might not be our biggest friend in the world, but I don't think that Russia or the other former Soviet states are going to launch that attack. There's some tiny probability. If you now say, what's the likelihood that a million Americans die in some event? Well, one of them would be that strategic nuclear attack. But that's very low probability. Is it more likely or less likely that a terrorist leads a bioterror attack against the United States or somewhere else that has blowback in the U.S. than a Soviet missile attack? So in that case, I'd say, look, for historical reasons, we had this nuclear threat and this nuclear deterrence. Maybe we should keep it going. I'm not saying that it's a bad thing, but it is a new and different world. And on September 10th... interesting. Literally, it's September 10th when we're recording this. On September 10th of 2001, I don't think very many people would have listed a terrorist attack by fanatical Islamist groups would be the biggest threat to killing thousands of Americans in a single incident. A few people would have, but that wasn't a very widely spread threat. By September 11th, we knew that it was a possibility.
And so when you talk to people about this thesis, do most people react by saying, you're nuts, you're an alarmist, this is about as likely as, a major earthquake and there's about as little you can do about it? Or are people in general receptive to the idea that we have a problem and we have misaligned priorities and there is a lot we could be doing about it?
Most of the response that I've gotten so far has been positive to the thesis that there is something there. I've had some people say, "Oh no, you're totally wrong, Nathan. The threat's worse than you've made it out to be." certainly, one of the questions that comes up is, "Hey, is there anything we can do about it?" And I say, yes, there is something we can do about it. And it doesn't require giant resources. I'm not talking about like the whole Cold War investment all over again. It's nothing like that. Let's take SARS as a good example. SARS is a naturally occurring virus. It's not an engineered bioweapon. But for all we knew, it was when it hit. It apparently infected somebody in southern China who stayed at a hotel in Hong Kong and was on the same floor as another guest. They never met, but through the air conditioning vent, the other guy gets sick. He boards a plane to Toronto. He gets sick, goes to a hospital, dies. Everyone in the hospital gets sick. What do? They send them to other hospitals, and the epidemic spreads. So within a few days of this occurring in China, it's shut down every hospital in Toronto. Now, that is a lesson in several things. First of all, there was no early detection system that figured this out. The people in Toronto who took the sick folks at the hospital to other hospitals were doing what they thought was the smartest possible thing. It turned out it wasn't a smart thing in retrospect, but they were trying the best that they could. They made it worse, but hey, at least it was Canada. If the guy from Hong Kong had gotten on a plane to a populous third world city, if he'd gone to Jakarta, he'd gone to Calcutta, he'd gone to any one of a number of other places, thousands or tens of thousands of people would have died before the thing got ring-fenced and appropriately dealt with. So if SARS can come from nowhere, take us by surprise, and be so deadly in an advanced nation, why could a terror attack could follow that exact playbook? But guess what? Small amounts of things at multiple stages could have detected SARS earlier, could have helped us respond better.
So is this simply an area where security interests and general good public health policy come together and essentially are the same thing, i.e., we need to do something very serious about infectious disease across the board in the surveillance arena, in the treatment arena, in the development of vaccines arena, in the, you know, or is there some specialized set of concerns and set of policies that you would want to see put in place for the security side of this that is not generally applicable to sort of general public health and infectious disease problems?
Well, I think the problem bifurcates into two pieces. One piece, the therapeutic piece of how you respond to a mystery virus, that's very closely related to what happens in a natural pandemic. And so I think it's a happy coincidence that if we make, for example, broad-spectrum antiviral drugs, surveillance things for detecting new pathogens, very rapid systems for sequencing and understanding a brand new pathogen, that work does dual duty. It helps us against the engineered terror weapon, and it helps us against the natural pandemic. And we're going to have more of both. We've had several incidents of bioattack. We've had several natural pandemics. The public has gotten a little bit blasé about flu because we've had a couple of false alarms, but there will be an influenza epidemic, another bad one, like the 1918 epidemic, and that could easily kill hundreds of millions of people, literally hundreds of millions. It's a different world now than it was in 1918. You do the math, it could be terrible. So I think it's wonderful that about half of the work does dual duty. There's another half that really is national security focused.
So what does that look like? I imagine there's a much broader constituency for the first half politically than the second half.
So I think the issue with the national security stuff is how do we think about dealing with something which is that deadly? Does that change the way we view intelligence gathering? Now, it's a funny time to be having that, given that we're in the enormous scandal surrounding Edward Snowden and his disclosures. It's sort of a low point in the notion of intelligence gathering and, hey, we ought to do more. But I'm actually here to say, no, actually, we ought to do more because this threat is big enough that we're going to look pretty damn foolish if after the fact we could have detected it and we didn't.
So what is a surveillance program devoted to biological agents look like?
So when people start getting sick all of a sudden someplace, how do you rapidly figure out what it is? That's one. It's one kind of surveillance. There's another kind of surveillance to say, who seems to be amassing the capabilities to do this in terms of experts, in terms of specialized equipment, in terms of delivery things. Of course, I'm sure our existing national security apparatus does try to look at those things. There's some very dedicated people trying to do it, but trying to interdict and stop all these things from happening. I think they could use both technological help. There's new tools that need to be developed. I think they could also benefit from some focus.
So this is one of the key points in your paper, that you look at the U.S. government and you say, who's in charge of preventing this from happening? And you don't see an organizational structure that sort of answers that question. You've now had a bunch of conversations with people in the U.S. government about this. Does that change your view of it at all?
Well, I've not had I haven't talked to everyone yet, of course, but I haven't had any senior officials say, hey, Nathan, calm down. We got it covered. We're all fine. Nobody says that. If you took the Soviet missile threat, I would argue we have that one very well solved. First of all, because they're not going to launch, very likely. Maybe North Korea will launch some missile aimed at Japan. There's all kinds of bad things that could happen in the world. But there we have huge numbers of dedicated people that practice once a week. They know exactly what to do, how to wake the president up, how to, you know, decide whether to launch. There's a whole protocol. Every major American city has a bomb squad. How many of them have a bio squad?
How many of them do?
I don't think any really do. Now, I may be slightly wrong, but there's a just reading on the plane on the way out here about a physician who took it upon himself to test his own city's capability. So he got X-ray images of people with anthrax and had a whole variety of things, and he went around his city trying to get consults with emergency room doctors and other specialists saying, hey, I've got a patient who's presenting like this. What is it? Essentially everyone said, you know, I think it's the flu. Tell him to go home and call you tomorrow. So he was alarmed by this in his response, and I think that although on paper we may have some level of some detection, we have hazardous material teams in some cities, I think probably more oriented around chemicals, frankly, than infectious bioweapons. But in the case of SARS, in the case of MERS, which is more recent, that emerged actually in the Mideast, we were all kind of caught flat-footed, and I think we still would be today.
Are we making progress in that regard, or is it, or are we sort of stagnating?
Well, I'm not the right guy to answer that at the moment. I'm an amateur at all this. I'm not a professional. the part that I have tried to apply myself to is the long-term trend of saying, look, the technology is becoming cheaper and easier, and will continue to for some time. Cheaper, easier, and more powerful. And there's tremendous good in that, by the way. Understanding DNA, understanding how it causes disease, is going to allow us to conquer cancer and many other important diseases. We need that knowledge. But that knowledge comes with a potential downside. And if we don't actively work towards it, we're going to wake up one day to a real calamity. And if we can just get even a little bit more organized now, I think that we'll make that less likely and make our response to it much better. And small differences could be measured in thousands or tens of thousands of lives. So I think it's worth doing.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you for listening to the Lawfare Podcast, produced in collaboration with the Brookings Institution. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.